There's a theory that the etymology of the word abracadabra comes from the Aramaic language, predecessor to both Hebrew and Arabic, stemming from avra kadavra, which translates to, it will be created in my words. On today's show, we're going to take a closer look at magic by way of the Passover story, the 10 plagues, and a game of magical back and forth between Moses and Pharaoh's sorcerers. To help us do so, we're enlisting the help of world-famous Jewish witch Pam Grossman, whom Vulture has called the Terry Gross of witches, is an acclaimed writer. Her book Waking the Witch, Reflection on Women, Magic, and Power was published by Simon & Schuster in 2019. Pam is also a podcast host. Check out The Witch Wave wherever you are listening to this right now. In addition to being a celebrated thinker who has been featured in The New York Times, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, Huffington Post, and more, Pam is Hollywood's go-to advisor for shows like The Craft. Pam will share her journey through paganism by way of Judaism, and she'll talk about how she's intertwined the two. We'll also unpack the ancient practice of deciphering good magic from bad magic, as well as the importance and power in ritual. Zooming out a bit, I wanted to mention that we're going to be switching things up with how we host this show. Rabbi Adam had to take the week off, but to help round out the show, we've invited Professor Fanny Bialik from our first intro episode to provide an academic perspective on religion's place in history. Due to the bandwidth and commitment it takes to make a weekly podcast, we'll actually be starting what we're thinking of as a rabbi-in-residence idea. Don't worry, Rabbi Adam will still join from time to time. But instead of being our only co-host, we'll be inviting rabbis and academics from all over the world to come and learn with us, teach us, and impart their wisdom and knowledge as rotating co-hosts. We're excited to have the opportunity for this show to be a diverse sampling of rabbinical and academic perspectives from all walks of life and backgrounds. And while change can be uncomfortable, we'd love for you to stick around and join us in the fun. Now, to make this all possible, I do have to ask for your help. While it may seem that we gather once a week for an hour to have these conversations, this undertaking is a project we work on daily. Research, scheduling, editing, revising, studying, logistics. I'm not gonna lie when I say it takes a lot of time, effort, and funds. But we love to do it, and I'm so excited and honored when I hear from listeners around the world who have made this show a part of their weekly practice and Shabbat ritual. So we've set up a Patreon page to help support the show, and if you'd be willing to toss in $5 a month, we'd be so, so grateful. For the price of one fancy coffee a month, you can help keep the show alive. As you've probably heard, it has not been an easy time for artists this past year, and while I am so down to pay out of pocket, if you feel inspired and enriched by this show, we'd love and appreciate the support. Head over to patreon.com/thestudy to pitch in and help make this everything we know it can be. Okay, on to the show. We are shaking it up here on The Study, and I'm very excited to welcome back to the show author and assistant professor at the John C. Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis, Fanny Bialik. Thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
And today in the hot seat, our favorite Jewish witch, we have Pam Grossman. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh man, I've been looking forward to this episode for a while now. And I think before we get into the Parsha stuff, I just want to get some context, especially on your perspective and where that'll take us today. Pam, can you help me understand what are witches?
I can certainly try. And It's funny, you would think I would have this really pithy answer for you since this is what I've devoted a lot of my life and my work to. But actually, that word witch means a lot of different things depending on context. I think if we're using it in the broadest sense of the word, it generally means someone who uses magic. Usually that person is a woman or on the feminine end of the spectrum, but not always. And then in the more contemporary sense, and in the sense that I use that word when describing myself, it's also a word that can refer to anyone who sees themselves as what I would describe as a carrier of divine feminine energy. So I'm a practicing pagan. I'm also Jewish. I call myself a Jew witch sometimes when I'm being cheeky. Certainly, my pagan practice is a big part of why I call myself a witch, and there is some spellcraft and magic involved in that. But it's also a word that I use to re-signify the misogynistic word witch, which a lot of people used to oppress and sometimes take the lives of women. So it's very, very loaded. And that's the shortest answer I can come up with. Can you believe that?
It's beautiful. I'm wondering about, you talk about paganism, and I guess I'm wondering how the form of modern paganism relates to prior centuries of practices of witchcraft?
I guess the quickest way of addressing paganism is, paganism in the modern sense of the word can describe those of us who see divinity in nature and in everything. It's people who see divinity as immanent, by which I mean it's infused in absolutely everything. So there's certainly an aspect of worship, or at least relationship, divine relationship with nature and every living being, and with some sort of, I suppose I'll call it higher power. You know, I call it spirit with a capital S. And in terms of kind of the modern pagan movement, a lot of it is kind of derived, and I'm being very, very quick about this, from the modern Wiccan movement. You guys have probably heard of Wicca. And this is actually a religion which was popularized in the middle of the 20th century. There were folks, some might be familiar with the name Gerald Gardner. He was one of many, many other folks, primarily out of England, who decided to weave together what he believed was a revival of British pagan practices. And he was also kind of mashing it up with different practices of Freemasonry, of different ceremonial practices of various secret societies that he was a member of. And he has, and his contemporaries kind of created this new religion that purported to be a revival of an old religion. Though there are certainly many people who are pagan, like I am, who do not necessarily consider themselves Wiccan. So pagan is kind of an umbrella term, and Wicca is kind of one, I'm mixing my metaphors here, but one spoke of that umbrella.
That's very helpful to understand. And I have one more hard-hitting question off the bat, because you're also Jewish. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your relationship to Judaism and how it intersects or is at odds with your practice as a witch.
You know, I'm sure other people have talked about this on your show before, but being Jewish is such a strange, rubbery thing and very elastic. At times in my life, when I didn't really identify with the religious part of Judaism, it's not like I stopped being Jewish, right? Because it's also part of our lineage. It's part of our family heritage and traditions. You know, I'm sure many people have described themselves as culturally Jewish, if not, you know, actually practicing, you know, various aspects of Jewish ritual. So My Judaism, it certainly evolved over the years. I grew up in Central Jersey. I was surrounded by lots of Jewish kids at school. You know, I had a bat mitzvah. I went to Hebrew school. We celebrated some of the Jewish holidays, but not all of them. You know, the big major ones, not the minor ones. We were, and I suppose still are, Reform Jews. We didn't keep kosher. It's not like we celebrated Shabbat every single Friday. So I think, you know, flexi Jew is maybe the best way to describe how I was raised. But it was still very much part of my familial identity, especially in terms of our family story of my great-grandparents and in some cases, great-great-parents came over from Europe to New York City to escape terrible oppression. That's a really big part of my ancestral lineage and my identity, and it's really important to honor that. And it certainly shaped me in terms of, I think, my own identity as always feeling somewhat as an outsider. You know, I think if you are a Jewish person, even if you're not super religious, there's still a sense of being an outsider or an underdog, at least here in America, which is, you know, it purports to be this super everybody's welcome American dream place, but we still have the rhetoric of Christianity, which is woven throughout all of our founding documents. And we still have, you know, I mean, I don't have to go into all that, right? We know what I'm talking about. I was very attracted to witchcraft and magic and mythology as a young person. And so even though I was going to Hebrew school and I got a lot of value out of some of those morals and rituals, I was way more into like casting spells and being out in the woods, communing with nature, connecting with the moon, very into, you know, mythology of all different cultures. And so that was as much a part of my spiritual life and my interior life as Judaism was. And as I got older, I moved even further away from Judaism. And again, it's not like I ever stopped considering myself to be Jewish, but I didn't really go to temple. I would celebrate the holidays out of respect for my family, but it didn't really feel as spiritually personal as my witchcraft did and my identity as a pagan. And only now, I'm actually about to turn 40, and for a whole host of reasons, which we may or may not have time to get into, I've started circling back to Judaism and really finding a lot of the mysticism and mystery and moon magic. You know, Judaism is such a lunar-based practice. That's all become really important to me again, and connecting to my ancestral magic and honoring and communing with the spirits of my family has become really important to me. So I'm kind of weaving Judaism back into my paganism, interestingly enough.
Well, let's weave some Judaism in here with this week's Parsha. And because Rabbi Adam isn't here, I'll be taking the summary reins, as it were. And because I'm a little nervous and I'm filling some pretty amazing shoes, I might help myself out in the edit with some like Lord of the Rings soundtrack or something. We are in the 14th Parsha of Torah, Vayera, and have we got a wild one? If we remember, the Israelites are an enslaved people in Egypt with a totally xenophobic and racist pharaoh in charge. Moses is now an 80-year-old man, and we find him back in conversation with God, who tells him, not to worry, I, your God, will free the Israelites from slavery. You know what? In fact, why don't you go let them know? So Moses goes to the people and says, hey, you have a God who's going to free you. And the Israelites are basically like, yeah, right, we've lost all hope. Go take a hike. So Moses goes back to God and says, look, they're not listening to me. And God's like, okay, well, here's what you're going to do. Go to Pharaoh and tell him to let the Israelites go. And then something relatable happens, which is that Moses experiences imposter syndrome and doubts his qualifications. He says, should I? I mean, why would he listen to me? The Israelites didn't listen to me. Plus, I have the speech impediment. And it's up for debate. Moses either actually had a speech impediment or was very good at making excuses. But God says, look, just do what I say. Take your brother Aaron, and Aaron will do the talking for you. When you get to Pharaoh, he's going to ask you to produce your marvel. At which point, you tell Aaron to put his cane down on the floor, and I'll turn it into a snake. So Moses is like, right on. Let's go, Aaron. And they head off to see Pharaoh, who indeed asks for a marvel. Aaron puts his cane on the floor, and exactly as planned, it turns into a serpent. But Pharaoh isn't impressed. He calls his court sorcerers and what the Torah calls the Egyptian magicians, which sounds like a great basketball team, and they all put their canes on the floor, which also turn into serpents. Suddenly, Aaron's cane snake devours all the other cane snakes, which feels like a pretty impressive flourish, but to no avail. Pharaoh's heart hardens, and he walks away. So God kind of rolls his eyes and is like, ugh, Pharaoh's so stubborn, he's a harder nut to crack than we thought. Tomorrow morning, when he's down at the Nile River for his morning sip of water, go tell him, let my people go, and hit the water with your cane, at which point I'll turn the entire river into blood. All the fish will die, the water will be stinky, and that should sufficiently freak him out. And Moses is like, cool, cool. He takes Aaron, they do exactly as they're told, the Nile turns into blood, but then Pharaoh's like, my sorcerers can do that, and shrugs and walks away. So God says, how about we try frogs? So Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh, proclaim, let my people go, or we're gonna make it rain frogs. Pharaoh says, oh, you wanna see frogs? And all the magicians in all of Egypt cast their frog-raining spell, and the land was peppered in reptiles. Now, for whatever reason, this was the final straw for Pharaoh, who calls Aaron and Moses and says, okay, 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 get rid of the frogs, and I'll let everyone go. So God does just that. The frogs all die out, but Pharaoh gets cocky and is like, you know what? Never mind. So God says, okay, Moses, let's get weird. Moses hits the ground with his cane, and all dust turns to lice. And somehow, this was the spell that the Egyptian magicians couldn't repeat. The magicians say, whoa, we can't do that. This must be God for real. But Pharaoh isn't so sure. So God and Moses are like, let's get biblical. They send insects, then kill all the Egyptian livestock with a pestilence. God has Moses toss some dust in the air, and it turns into a plague of boils on all the Egyptian men. They send an insane hail and lightning storm. And still, Pharaoh is like, meh. And crazily enough, that is where this parsha leaves off. So, with all that in mind, unless we are supposed to read this literally, because we haven't really done that on this show yet, right? We've been kind of parsing out what the meaning might be. It all, to me, feels like a myth or a fairy tale, perhaps like an Afikoman style thing to get people's attention. And then we tell a wild story that you can't forget, then ascribe meaning yourself. But I do want to focus on these plagues and talk about ascribed meaning. Fanny, we just so happen to be living in a modern day plague of the COVID variety. How have contemporary religious or spiritual groups, Jewish, Christian, or anyone, contextualized or made sense of COVID within their belief systems? I'm wondering what kind of meanings these groups have ascribed, if any, and how that might differ from the past, because it seems that historically, events like the Spanish flu were contextualized within a religious belief system, whereas now our more secular society seems like less likely to attribute such events to God or other supernatural forces. But is that universally the case among contemporary religious and spiritual groups? What's changed over time to cause this shift?
I think yes and no. And maybe what sounds like a cop-out answer might be importantly the right answer right now, which is that we don't quite know yet. And the fact that we don't quite know yet is interesting to me. So often when we've had really spectacular moments of disruption to our lives in history, the meaning making has happened very quickly in response to it. often badly. So, for instance, 9/11 happens, and the next weekend, people are preaching about this being so-and-so's fault and so-and-so's fault, etc., and trying to fit it into a divine meaning-making structure right away before we even really know what happened. I think back to the Lisbon earthquake, most especially, that the disaster that sort of perfected the practice of people saying this was clearly punishment in our more modern world, or sort of at the start of our modern, of Western modernity. The recent example that's closest to COVID is with the AIDS epidemic, that was endlessly moralized from very, very early on, of course, in part because a very specific group of people was most affected by it before we even called it AIDS. And so the opportunity for meaning making as this is punishment for something seemed so at the ready. One thing that I'm finding interesting in COVID is that we're not seeing as much of that. And I think that part of that is because there's a lot of disruption to people's ritual practice. And so many clergy members of all kinds, religious practitioners of all kinds, have been scrambling just to figure out how to do anything that is meaning-making right now, whether that's in the really specific or sort of logistical sense of, like, what does it mean to put all your services on Zoom or those sorts of things, to some of the more pastoral elements of, like, how do you help people do meaning making around death and sickness when we're not able to gather? Like, these logistical challenges of this being a pandemic where we're not able to come together around things, I think, have occupied a lot of religious leaders' energy, to put it in a sort of blunt way, maybe to let them off the hook. But I think also the way that it's not obvious that there is a specific group who's being targeted, you don't see in the mainstream nearly as much discussion of that. Now, there has been a lot of, especially on the left, organized religion condemnation of the inequality of healthcare and outcomes. And so in that sense, there is a sort of specific population in mind, but that's kind of in the opposite direction from what was happening with the AIDS epidemic. So the reason that I think this is kind of an interesting phenomenon, that there's been so much more effort on the part of a lot of clergy members to think about how we do the rituals than to think about what is the divine reason for this, or how do we make meaning in relation to some form of punishment, is that in some ways it picks up on some of the themes of the portion this week, that the parsha is about which rituals are sufficiently impressive, or which things are sort of outliers to ritual that might be impressive because of the way they're outliers. And I think that this project of ritual innovation is crucial for what a lot of mainstream religious actors are thinking about during COVID, that we need ritual innovation, we need new things. Some of them are turning to spaces where ritual innovation has been more common, or maybe even is at the heart of some people's religious practice. And one of those places is paganism and witchcraft, where ritual innovation is not outside the norm, but is part of what you're doing. So I'm excited to have that conversation more with you, Pam, and would love to hear what you think, too, about the contextualization of COVID in witchcraft or in other religious spaces.
One of the beautiful things about the contemporary pagan movement is that we are very scrappy. We don't have one book that we have to follow, with all due respect. You know, we don't. We don't have one leader. You know, we often say we don't have a pope of witchcraft. We all kind of, it's a bit DIY, and that makes it really personal. It also makes it very slippery and hard to codify and hard to organize. But it does mean that we don't have certain rituals that we absolutely must do at certain times of the year. Of course, there are moments of the lunar cycle, or there are pagan holidays that we celebrate if we choose to. You know, there have been many different Zoom coven meetings and rituals around grieving, around healing, around, you know, sending good energy to those who have COVID, lots of protective magic rituals, certainly lots of energy around the various elections and political moments that we're living through. And I think that's something that's really, really beautiful, that we can rely on ourselves and our own creativity to make rituals that meet the moment.
We've all heard about the physical and mental benefits of meditation, yoga, and making time in our life to slow down. So why is it often so hard to actually do it? OneTable's digital video series, Pause, offers viewers a way to kick off their Shabbat practice with interviews and sessions from your favorite artists who join to help us answer that perennial question. We're proud to partner with One Table to assist in helping you get your weekly dose of Shabbat. Check out the new episode at onetable.org/pause.
Something that I've been exploring for myself is that one of the pleasures of participating in Judaism, and I imagine this is true for others who participate in traditional religions, is this organizing principles that would require that I confront beliefs and practices that I don't agree with. To an extent, I can pick and choose my Judaism. You know, we could identify lots of practices among others who are Reform or Conservative or Reconstructionist or Orthodox. But regardless of what sect I'm a part of, there are aspects of Judaism, such as its problematic treatment of gender historically, that can't be ignored, that they're a part of the practice's history, regardless of denomination, and I have to take that into account and face them. So part of being Jewish is to confront and reconcile things within Judaism that make me uncomfortable, which I guess is also analogous to living in a society. But thinking about how witchcraft is organized and practiced relative to more traditional religions, it's less normative in its organizing principles, I think is kind of what you were saying. And I'm curious to know what you gain or lose as a result of that.
I mean, certainly what I think I gain from it is the ability to trust my intuition and trust my direct experience of the divine and to be a co-creator in my spiritual life, co-creator with spirit, as opposed to, you know, being given this whole, you know, list of traditions and things I must do. And for me, that's very freeing. You know, I'm also a writer and practice different art forms throughout my whole life. One of the reasons that witchcraft is so popular with creative people is because, you know, we are to some degree expected to kind of invent this as we go along. To certainly we can look up spells in a spell book or different rituals and follow, you know, by the numbers, but we're very encouraged to write our own spells and our own rituals, and so there's a lot of creativity that I love. It's not quite so calcified. And let's be clear, Judaism has changed a lot. I mean, I remember this moment. I must have been in elementary school where my temple, and again, it was already a pretty liberal, flexible place. My temple swapped out our old prayer books, which used the pronoun he for God. And we got new prayer books that just said God. And our old prayer books, a lot of the prayers had all of the forefathers' names. And our new prayer books added Rebecca, Leah, Sarah to the prayers. This was a decision that people made. You know, this was a decision to evolve Judaism forward. I went to my mother's bat mitzvah because my mom couldn't get bat mitzvahed when she was, this would have been, I guess, the 60s when she was 13. They didn't do bat mitzvahs. They didn't, you know, you had to be a boy. And so when my mom, I think, was in her 40s, she got bat mitzvahed because suddenly Judaism decided, at least in our sect of Judaism, that women should be able to have a bat mitzvah. And that left a huge impression on me. So I'm not trying to imply that Judaism doesn't also evolve, because it does. And I think all religions should. I think we get into dangerous territory and fundamentalist territory when we think we're supposed to take everything literally and not question it and not continue to evolve it. You know, in terms of what I lose, I don't know that I've lost anything because I have not, you know, I've not walked away from Judaism. So that connection to my family history, which I think might have been lost if I completely rejected Judaism in its entirety, I think I would have really felt that. And, you know, I have a lot of people in my family history that I would consider kind of witchy. Like, we have this whole kind of myth of healing hands that people, the women in my family on one side of my family, allegedly have, right? Like, and I think all of us, if we go back far enough, we'll find herbalists and healers and people who were communing with the moon, you know, no matter what our background is. Not having familial elders who really identified as witches is something that, you know, I suppose could be seen as a loss, but I found those elders in my chosen family, and I've learned from elders who, you know, are pagan. So I don't know that I feel a lot of loss around it. I'm an additive kind of person. I'm a, like, you know, both and kind of witch.
I appreciate that. I really appreciate this conversation around reconciling both our own, or the religion that we're given, and chosen lifestyles. Because even in the Torah, when it comes to magic, the righteous have access and are permitted to make use of occult knowledge. And those include, like, dreams and soothsaying, where later thinkers talk of approved uses of reading of faces and palms, spirit possession, sorcery, among other things. And the Talmud, for example, includes stories of rabbis using magic to heal and harm. But in the Torah specifically, magic is forbidden. So there's this weird historical distinction where religious mysticism is okay, but magic is not, which seems to imply that there is good religion and bad religion. Fanny, can you help us unpack and understand this at all?
I think the way you laid it out is beautiful, that a big part of what the prohibition in the Torah and then the various forms of allowance in Talmud and in other later Jewish sources suggests is that there is some standard there of what is good religion and what is bad religion, or in this case, what is good magic and what is bad magic. Another way to think about it has a lot to do with where sovereignty and where power is. And so in the Torah, the kind of magic that gets forbidden is magic that presents a power that challenges God's power and that looks a little bit like God's power, which is something that you're not supposed to say. So there isn't supposed to be a power that is like God's, but then there are these people who are doing this thing that looks kind of like God's power. And that stuff is what you're not supposed to do if you're going to be, especially if you're part of the chosen people. And there are readings of that are primarily about the way that that's a form of idolatry. There are readings of that are in some ways more about being part of the wrong group or not knowing what group you're part of, that sort of acknowledge that magic might be happening and might be powerful, that there are other gods or that there are other forces. And as a Jew, you just shouldn't go do the thing that they're doing. And that's actually what the prohibition is about. So, I think there are different ways of thinking about that, whether it's bad magic because magic is bad in the version where it's idolatrous, or whether it's bad magic because it's just the other people's magic. And both of those can come out of some of the same texts and some of the texts that we have here. And in some ways, that's a question I'd love to put to Pam, is in that sense of sort of good magic, bad magic. I know in the contemporary pagan context, there's criticism. You know, there's not always agreement about what things are good magic and what things are bad magic. In Judaism, there's this very specific attempt in Torah and then in Talmud to try to define it, however successful it might be. And I'm wondering what that looks like in contemporary paganism, sort of what your sense of the good, bad magic distinctions might be.
Yeah, well, I want to address the first part, which is just, you know, kind of the good magic and the bad magic in the Torah. So translation in general is always a game of telephone, but especially when it comes to translating the Torah or the Bible in general, right? And so the word witch is used in English all the time throughout the Bible. And we see many, many different iterations of this. So there's that famous passage from Exodus that says, "Thou shall not suffer a witch to live." And that English passage was used to rationalize, you know, the slaying of many people in Europe and later in the New England colonies here in America. But that word witch actually comes from a Hebrew word, and I'm afraid I'm going to mispronounce this, so do pipe in. I believe it's mechashefa, That word, mechashefa, we're not even entirely sure what it means. Some people think it means poisoner. Some people think it means one who utters different spells. So we can't even agree on that, right? Then we have other, you know, words that describe different kinds of magic makers, whether it's soothsayers or people who could raise the dead. My favorite example of this is the character that we know as the Witch of Endor. She didn't get called a witch until the 16th century. You know, before that, she was referred to as sometimes a pythoness in English. Sometimes she was referred to this Latin phrase, I'm going to mangle this too, mulierem habentum pythonem, which, you know, essentially is like the Oracle of Delphi, who was a pythoness, somebody who could speak to, you know, the gods or get different kind of messages from the other side, if you will. And so, you know, if you think of the Witch of Endor, her original description word in Hebrew is Ba'alat Ab or Ba'alat Av. And that essentially means mistress of the ob. Now, what is an ob? It is translated as a vessel that you could hold a spirit in. So she was somebody who could raise the dead. She's not a witch necessarily in the sense that we might think of a witch today. My point of all this is that we don't even know exactly what they were, what the original authors of these texts were referring to. Additionally, you know, I love your point about, well, maybe magic or miracles are okay if it's coming from God. But that then begs the question, like, well, which God, right? Because there were lots of people doing lots of what we would call magic who were interfacing with their own version of God or many gods. I married a man who is not religious himself, but my husband's father is an Episcopal priest. And he and I have so many different really juicy discussions about what magic is versus miracles. Like, what is the difference? I mean, you know, if Jesus, a nice Jewish boy, could turn water into wine, isn't that witchcraft? Hmm. I mean, my father-in-law would argue no, because God gave him that power. And it's like, well, you know, so we're really getting into parsing all of these different definitions of what magic even is and why is it considered threatening. There are many, many different ways to interpret all of this. And I just think it's juicy, but very complicated.
In religious studies, or in the study of religion, so often, especially in sort of traditional religious studies, I was still so dominated by an Anglo-Protestant sense of what, or not just Anglo, but a Western Protestant sense of what religion could be. The use of magic versus religion was basically a way of saying there are good religions and there are bad things called magic. So anything called magic is just a bad thing. And then the things called called religion are the things that are real, that you can study or that respectable people do or whatever it is. So lots of contemporary religious studies scholars have tried to break this down, obviously for methodological reasons as much as for the liberatory reasons of it. But I think that that's a funny kind of contemporary or scholarly mirror to this question of sort of where the good and bad is doing the work, and where contentful distinctions between, say, magic and a miracle might be more at play.
A term that you brought up in the beginning of the show that I just want to make sure I understand correctly. So for my and our listeners' edification, can you talk about the term divine feminine and maybe its place in witchcraft and Judaism and your own practice?
Ooh, yes. It's so difficult because when we talk about masculine and feminine, we are talking in binaries. And I know that we're also in, I don't even want to call it a moment because that seems to trivialize it, but a lot of the work that we're doing in our society right now is around spectrums and not binaries. You know, I'm thinking, of course, of gender, for example. That said, a spectrum can have, you know, kind of the end points on either side of it. Now I'm thinking of a spectrum as a circle, and isn't that a gorgeous thing? Mm. But if we're talking about, you know, traditional, there's that word again, models, to me, feminine has to do with intuition. It has to do with honoring the body and not only ideas and not only celestial. I'm waving my hands up above my head right now, you know, things on this other ethereal plane, but actually being here and present and finding magic and beauty and, let's say, God in the everyday. That to me feels very much relevant to the term divine feminine. And I will say, because we are speaking in words about ineffable things, which is always going to be challenging, right? Because we're flattening these beautiful big concepts with words. But that using feminine language alone feels very empowering to me when talking about divinity, because so much of the language that we, many of us, have been taught and that's been handed down to us has centered that male power. And so anyone who chooses to sometimes refer to God as she, or to talk about the goddess, I think this is useful for people of all gender identities, but especially for those of us who haven't been able to recognize ourselves in the stories and rituals of allegedly the most divine, highest expressions of humanity. Like, it's really empowering to get to use she, to get to use that language when talking about divinity, because that or they, right? If we're going to use all pronouns. I just know that I sense something shift in my body when I talk about, you know, the goddess. I feel part of that. And I believe that all human beings have all genders in them and masculinity and femininity in us. That said, as someone who does identify as a woman and really feels that as my personal truth, when you grow up and most of the stories center, you know, Bilbo Baggins, Batman, and Buddha, right? Like, you can't wow. help but internalize that. And so getting to have a divine she really helps me step into my own power as a feminine being.
I'd love to circle back to something just in the Parsha, which is that a lot of readings of this Parsha emphasize that in the magic ritual that happens first, Moses's staff is put on the ground and it changes into a snake. Whereas the Egyptian magicians, I love this basketball team idea, the Egyptian magicians have to perform a ritual around it. And one of the readings of that is that the power, as you said at the beginning, comes from God for Moses, whereas it has to come from doing this work on it. And there are lots of rabbinic interpretations that say that doing all of that work shows that it's not real power. And I took, or it is real power, but it's a sort of messy, it's not as good as the other kind of power. And that the Egyptians are really impressed by the fact that the staff just turns into a snake without him having to perform any ritual. That's part of what scares them. And at the beginning of this conversation, you talked about witchcraft and paganism as thinking about an immanent divine, an immanent divine. But I was wondering if you also think about it as that kind of work and what role your work is in that. I think at another point you talked about being a co-creator with spirit. And so maybe in this moment when I think a lot of people are feeling helpless in relation to political questions and also to the dangers of COVID, that it feels like we're not co-creating creators of much all the time. I was wondering if you could reflect on that and what is the empowerment of that, and whether we should be more impressed with the magicians or with Moses on this one.
Ooh, that's so juicy. I believe that ritual is deeply important and deeply useful, and that it means that we do have to put effort into it and intention. There's that word again. It takes time. So if I could just wave a magic wand and have whatever I wanted to happen, wow, wouldn't that be an amazing power? Also kind of dangerous, right? Because we are fallible human beings and not all of our whims should come true or come into fruition. I truly do believe that there are some people that have different kinds of powers and access to powers that I don't even fully understand. I do believe that there are some people who probably can talk to the dead in a way that I can't, and that there are different kinds of magical gifts that different people might have, and they're just born with that. I certainly do believe that. But I also believe that even if you're not born with a gift like that, or you haven't yet accessed it, that ritual is for everybody. And that spells are something anybody really can do if they want to. And that being able to gather materials and be mindful of the words you're using and how it feels in your body and the way that your energy is changing and the different levels of consciousness that you are then accessing when you are doing these rituals, I believe that that has a lot of benefit, because it means that we can truly take the time to be intentional. Because if you have to put effort into something, you're going to hopefully be more thoughtful about doing that magic. I don't know that one is better than the other. I know that work and craft, that word witchcraft, craft is a really important part of my practice. And it means that, yes, I'm accessing some sort of, I don't know, you can call it power, you can call it, you know, being in relationship or co-creation with spirit. But I'm also part of that as a human being in this little body, right? And I believe that there is value into putting time and thought and physicality into the change that we want to make in the world.
I really appreciate you, Pam, taking the time to study some Torah with us. Thank you, Fanny, for being here. Really, just so much fun.
Thank you. This was such a treat.
Thank you both so much.
And to all our listeners out there, Shabbat Shalom.
I believe there's magic here in these sails, in the wake of these old pirate trails.
The Study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host today was Fanny Bialik. Our guest was Pam Grossman. Artwork by Julia Pott. We'll see you next week.
It's in buried treasure under the sea and all the music.